Hey guys, this is your host Nitin Binhani and a very warm welcome to my startup podcast channel Jazair Audio, where we share real stories with real learnings. So in the first part, which was our previous podcast, we covered why the founders should always have boots on the ground. They must identify the key challenges of their customers and provide a frictionless solution to such challenges, all the while focusing on both growth and profitability. And now let's continue with a fresh set of questions for both Nitin and Vasant, the co-founders of Profitable Unicorn of Business. Hi Vasant and Nitin, welcome back to the podcast. Vasant, would you say that the combination of procurement and financing solutions really helped of business to its takeoff?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think that any commerce transaction in India has a layer of finance in it. You can call it trade credit or you can call it trade plus finance, right? You don't call it finance, you call it credit. That's how any B2B business works. There is no B2B business, either startup, old age, new age, that's run in India without embedded finance or credit in them. And hence, I think the realization of this and that you solve for both is, you know, very also critical. And in fact, that would also be a takeaway to most B2B businesses that's being built, that there will be embedded credit. How are you solving for it?
Nitin, as the founder of Profitable Unicorn, what would you advise to the B2B founders?
So I'll go with a couple, right? And Vasant probably can cover the rest. The first and the foremost is that people think that, you know, scale will bring unit economics into place. It does not. You have to think about unit economics on day one itself. Scale in B2B, with scale, the unit economics do not change that much. It may enhance a little bit, but it's not going to change drastically. So that's something that has to be solved for on day one or probably even day minus one, you know, before you begin. So that's extremely, extremely important to solve. The second piece of advice is that, you know, market is extremely big. So don't try the breadth first approach of going into different markets like, you know, starting Maharashtra, Karnataka, Tamil Nadu, Delhi at the same time. Pick a market, even the smallest of the smallest market will be massive. So go and solve whatever you're hypothesizing and whatever you think is going to work in that particular market, and then think about expanding to nearby markets. So first, take a length first approach rather than a breadth first approach. So that those would be my two sort of piece of advice for the budding entrepreneurs in the B2B market.
So does that mean a founder should start with a niche first?
Yeah. So, you know, when we started out, we were just solving two pain points for the customers, and those two pain points sort of became our niche, which was financing and raw material supply and aggregation. You know, how do you get the raw materials cheaper to the customers? But we did not try and solve that for aluminium and textiles initially. We just focused on steel and that's it. We cracked steel market and then we cracked it across India. And then we ventured out into other supply chains. And now we've gotten very good at it. But initially, we just stuck to our guns about solving it for one category and solving it completely. So that's what we did. That's what worked for us.
Vasant, do you want to add to it?
Yeah, absolutely. Nitin is right. Like, you know, no startup fails by doing too less. Most startups actually fail by doing too much. So the ability to say no, that no, I will not do this, is a very, very important skill set that B2B businesses and entrepreneurs and founders should have. No, I will not do it now. I might do it later, but no, I'm not going to do this now. Because when you say yes to something, you're reducing every other thing that you can probably say yes to, right? So I think the ability to say no and prioritize is very, very critical. The second thing is in the power of execution. While yes, long-term thought process and strategy matters, the truth is nothing in B2B is better than execution. I think the power of execution is insane. We have always, and even now at across the org, I think we look at our business week on week, month on month. There is a view. We obviously look at it from a long-term standpoint too. But I think the ability to constantly look at your business. Yes, I have done this week. Next week, I'll do 10% better. The next week, I'll do 10% better. The next week, I'll do 10% better. Just in the power of rigorous execution, where you view the business as a week-on-week or a month-on-month business without overthinking it, it is also, I think, very, very critical.
You mean the founder should create and religiously track a few relevant KPIs?
Yeah, don't even complicate it. Just take 2-3 KPIs and solve for it. Just run behind these KPIs on a weekly, monthly basis. Believe in the power of execution. And once, as you directionally see the business build up, you can solve more challenges that eventually come.
And what metrics were you tracking?
Yeah, I think two parts, right? I think tracking was, as I mentioned earlier, I think profitable repeat was the metric that we were constantly tracking. And I think a little subjectivity here, where you go and constantly get feedback and you know, iterative feedback that comes from the user that you're, you know, you hear so much, right? If today 50 customers tell you that, hey, I also need credit among 70 customers that you meet, and you know that, hey, you have to layer and solve for that solution. So I think just feedback, and for us, the North Goal metric was just profitable repeat.
Let's talk about product market fit. When did you think you achieved PMF?
So it took us, I think, about 3 or 4 months or 5 months to actually figure that out. Because initially when we began, we just focused on commerce. And we thought that we could just scale up commerce and without introducing credit into it. But very soon we realized that, you know, it is all interlinked with each other. So about 4 or 5 months when we introduced credit, actually it was more than 4 or 5 months, probably 6 or 7 months into our journey. That's when we realized that, you know, credit is an integral part of the ecosystem. Unless we solve for credit as well, we're not going to go anywhere. So once we introduced credit and we sort of said that it's going to be a commerce plus a financing business that we are building, not just a commerce business, not just a financing business, that was the time when we sort of cracked the product market fit.
Vasant, do you want to add to it?
I would add to this that two metrics would be repeat, which is critical. Our repeat numbers became so insane that today repeat is not even a metric we measure, because we know it's not of 85%, north of 85%. So the very fact that I think if there is product market fit, there will be repeat. So I think repeat in the business is a beautiful metric to tell you whether what you're doing is right, because it's very, whether it's push sales or it's pull, right? You obviously have to sell, but is there also constant repeat and demand coming? So I think repeat became a metric which, you know, very soon in the period within a year was at north of 80%. So we understood that yes, there is product market fit. But I think the repeat without having, you know, contribution positive margin repeat, I think that's the combination which was proof in the pudding that yes, there is a product market fit, that you are, there is repeat and you're making money at a contribution margin level. You're making money, you know, apart from your first year, you've been profitable, that there is path to monetize and you are monetizing it today. I think the combination of this is what, you know, made us understand that yes, product market fit is achieved. Even on the tech side, right? I think another thing that a lot of B2B businesses do, anyone who's building B2B SaaS in India, right? I think the problem is they try to solve too much for a behavioral change in the end user. I think behavioral change takes a lot of time. You have to solve for a problem with their current behavior. For example, we understood that any manufacturer or contractor was already having a tender team, a team for tenders and auctions to actually go online and go through thousands of websites to actually search for business opportunities. Railways will have a tender, BHEL will have a tender, NTPC will have a tender. And we realized that that was a behavior that was already established in the businesses that we were in. They were having a team to solve that problem. So we were like, let's start with a tender aggregation platform. And that became our largest customer acquisition tool called Bid Assist, where we said that yes, people will come online to procure, they'll come online for credit, yes, but they'll definitely come online, you know, to search for tenders, because they've been doing it anyway on a daily basis in the last years. So let's aggregate all these tenders together. We add like 20,000 tenders on a daily basis, becomes a single platform where all tenders are scraped and put together, eligibility, performance, everything can be tracked. And hence, when we were able to give this as a solution to customers, there wasn't a need for any cultural change or behavioral change in their usage. And it was what they were doing, and they found it easier. They had to work with 4 people, now they could do it with 2 people. And hence, I think that gave us the ability to also acquire customers. And that's also a proof in the pudding that, you know, there is product market fit, because you're not expecting a behavioral change in the SaaS solution that you are providing. And that also became a great takeaway for us that yes, this is the first tech platform to push, and then we will layer it with procurement, we'll layer it with finance, credit, and other solutions from a huge customer acquisition standpoint.
So what was your strategy for customer acquisition and growth?
So we obviously had, we had 3-4 products in mind, but when we sat with the customers and realized how their teams and their bandwidth of going online. So when we go to a customer and ask them, why would you go online, right? I think the simple question that was asked, the first question was, I will go online to search for government tenders, because every government, state department, public works department, every Navratna has its own website, has its own portal. I need to go scan through everything and I need to actually look at it. So the first reason I go online is to search for tenders. This was the answer that came to us when we asked them a simple question, why would you go online? And hence we realized that hence this problem should be solved first. And that's where we prioritized Bid Assist, you know, tender aggregation towards the solution. And then we realized that the moment you're solving for why they want to go online first. Then you also give your commerce solutions to them, which is your finance and your commerce solutions on top.
Nitin, was there any strategy acted upon to achieve PMF?
So it doesn't work that way. As Vasant pointed out earlier, we are till now heavily execution focused. So unless you execute on the ground and you figure out what's happening on the ground, you know, you want to figure out PMF and all, it's all not going to matter. So you obviously end up going on the ground, figuring out the PMF while you're on the ground. Unless you do that, nothing is going to matter, right? So get on the ground, you'll automatically figure out PMF, you'll automatically sit in the room and say that, okay, this is not working, this is working. That's how you figure out the PMF. You don't figure out the PMF by strategizing initially and then thinking about going and executing. You figure out the PMF by executing and then iterating it a little bit over a period of time, right? So it doesn't happen that it's an aha moment, oh, you figured out the PMF at one point of time, or it's an iterative process and execution is the only way to get there.
You mean to say keep a focus on execution and PMF will eventually follow?
Absolutely. And yeah, you will get better over a period of time because you will introspect almost on a daily basis, and that really works.
What was your go-to-market strategy to acquire and retain customers during the early stages?
There was a lot of benefit that comes in the businesses that we are in because there's great word of mouth and repeat. Whatever said and done, the SME, the B2B business is a trust deficit industry. And once you can solve for trust, you know, the compounding effects kick in, right? Like anything. Because it's very word of mouth, you know, it's very ecosystem driven. Whether it's objectively, the moment you look at an SME, he will be transacting with 10, 15 other SMEs. So the moment you tap into one, whether from the data or the transaction data you get, or by his soft recommendation, you're immediately connected to 10 other SMEs. Geographically, if you look at most parts of India, SMEs are concentrated. You'll have a cluster in Faridabad. You'll have a cluster in Manesar. You'll have, right? Everyone is very clustered. So whether it is how SMEs are geographically arranged or the way they transact with each other or general trust, which gets built through word of mouth, there is a lot of impact. Your ability to scale in B2B becomes extremely easier the moment you scale. So while the initial product, you know, once the initial product market fit is about constant feedback, profitable economics, and you know, pitching to the customer yourself and going and executing. Over time, after 2 years, after 3 years, you realize that those numbers, you know, go up 5 times, 10 times, because there's a lot of more inbound, repeat, word of mouth, data, transactional data coming in, because it's such a exploding network graph, you know, that gets built the way SMEs actually operate and are located.
And did the GTM change over the subsequent stages?
So once we figured out kind of, you know, what works in steel and sort of the market, it was literally a copy-paste strategy into other supply chains. So you have to get, that's why my advice is you have to get stuff right for one particular supply chain and learn whatever you can about that supply chain, and then becomes easier over a period of time, right? So in your journey from zero to one is always the hardest, where you're trying to figure out the PMF, you're trying to get your initial set of customers. You know, once you figure that out, the remaining journey becomes easier, but you have to spend that kind of time initially to really get your fundamentals right, and don't deviate from the fundamentals no matter what.
Yeah, I'll just add to Nitin. So if you look at the category that we built, right, I think it took the first 1 year to build cluster-wise capability and product market fit in steel. But the next category that we, you know, got into, that's because after building product market fit, is that say we got into a category of energy, we call it, which is petroleum, chemical, petroleum, oil, and other products. That became a 6-month process. The third category that we actually ventured into, which would say non-ferrous, you just repeat it, put your best folks in that territory and that product, just use the same playbook. We were able to get into that scale in a 3-month process. So I think that's the strategy we have sort of adopted everywhere, whether it's across geographical different regions. We started in typically pockets of Delhi NCR and Tamil Nadu and Hyderabad, but then we scaled to Bangalore, we scaled to East, we scaled to Gujarat, right? Just get to fit, product market fit, put your best guys, relocate or put your best guys to solve for a new product or new territory. Once you've got good scale in one, and then, you know, just repeat the process and you can actually, you realize that it's halfway there. So I think moving the right talent, people have built something and, you know, helping, using them to leverage a new territory or a new product has definitely helped, because you're just taking the learnings and replicating it, because all supply chains are broadly similar. The fundamentals of doing business in India are the same.
Earlier, you guys spoke about hiring the best talent and empowering them to do their own thing. The question is, how do you hire the best talent?
You know, for us, talent doesn't mean experience. For us, it's actually the opposite. Talent just means smartness. Talent just means passion. Talent just means hunger. For us, we have a very, very different definition of talent, right? So we figured out very initially, in our initial days, that listen, if you get the industry guys, they'll come with a lot of baggage. So for us, what has worked is that we kind of focus on getting youngsters into the system. So maybe, you know, go to IIMs or pick up a few chats from IITs and then really let them do their thing, throw them in the deep end of the ocean. So, you know, not just focus on getting the most experienced guys or getting the guys with you know, a lot of customers already in their kitty. So, you know, we never focused on that. So that's kind of worked for us. So for us, talent means hunger, hustle, passion to perform. Talent does not mean experience for us. Talent does not mean how many customers has he already cracked. Talent does not mean that.
So how did you create a performance-driven culture across half business?
Yeah. So I think hunger, which Nitin said, is the first filter we took for people, right? So our belief is to take good people and make them great. The idea is to not to take great people and use them to build the business, but the idea is to take good people. Typically, we went to, you know, business schools, but even in this, we would not go to a tier one like an ISB or an IMA, but we would actually go to, you know, business schools like we'd go to FMS, we'll go to IIM Rohtak, we'll go to Kozhikode, we'll go to Kashipur, and take the not the most experienced, but the hungriest to the guy who wants to perform, as well as the most hands-on and salesy guy from there, right? So I think the DNA for selection itself are people who want to move from good to great without any bias that they have worked in an industry or they have some prior experience. So once you filter for hunger and hustle and you tell them that, hey, you put them in a problem which where it is huge, huge markets, huge territories, and you empower them to build, and you sort of decentralize, you know, in terms of the org today, we have one guy leading one region, another guy leading another region, decentralized and empowered. This automatically makes them give their best because the canvas is set for them to sort of excel, to move from good to great. And that culturally was what we have said. Like today we are celebrating the sixth year for someone who leads the entire commerce business for us. But you won't believe that Vikram Singh joined us from FMS in 2017, but today leads a 1,000+ crore monthly P&L and 15 factories, right? That's how you take a good guy and make him great. He's one of the Forbes 30 under 32. So I think ensure that you are giving a platform for good to become great is very critical. And I think the other element that's obviously mattered for us is from day one, everyone in off business from day one has their, you know, equity in the company. There's a massive ESOP pool also allocated that they are a part of the company. We've also been able to, over the last 7 years, constantly not only grant, but also do buybacks or secondary transactions where people have actually been able to see value in the instrument and they've, you know, they're able to see that. 90% gets solved because most people, you know, want to grow in life. Monetarily, yes, that needs to grow along with it. But they also need to become great, right? Towards whether it's a territory, number of people reporting under them, or, you know, their metric of success. So 80% give them a large canvas, take good people and make them, you know, scale as much as they want. And second thing, 20% is obviously insane monetary growth, because most of them who have been with us they've obviously seen value grow 100x, right? Obviously adds to the benefit to grow leaders.
Nitin, off business has one of the largest ESOPs pool. What was the idea behind that?
Yeah, so what happens is that obviously, you know, they become part of the family, and then in family, we've always believed to sort of, you know, share very transparently. And just let them do their own thing after sharing a very, very transparent policy, right? So for us, nothing is hidden or nothing is sort of non-transparent. So we hold a very open monthly sort of podcast for the entire company. You can call it a mini town hall where we share everything, each and everything about the company. So we don't keep anything hidden. So, you know, that's actually helped us retain a lot of people as well. That's helped us in general in designing certain policies where people are very, very comfortable and they know that, you know, they will be taken well, they'll be taken care of. So we don't have anything hidden from them. So the policies also get designed on their own once we have the culture of transparency. So obviously, people who work and deliver for the organization get paid really well. And we maintain that there is no politics in and around it. It's very, very, very transparently laid down. It's very, very, very transparently communicated. And that's very important to ensure.
Yeah, and to add to that, you know, that's visible in the recruiting numbers too. In 2017, we got one person I mentioned from FMS. In 2019, it became 10. This year, we'll be closer to 15 to 20. This is per campus, right? So I think as long as you're very transparent and you work well with the batch, people from the other batch, you know, subsequent batch, word of mouth again, right? That's how it works. Follow blindly. And I think hence, when they have seen success of, there's a large sense of brotherhood and followership that also is there in the organization, in the way we recruit. And, you know, that's come because of the transparent policy town halls that Nitin was also mentioning, that naturally there has been more people reaching out to want to be a part of the larger family because they have seen their seniors, their people from their previous batch grow and benefit both monetarily as well as in terms of learning.
So essentially, starters must create a transparent ESOP policy and then openly share the progress or milestones achieved by them for transparency.
Absolutely.
Here's the summary for part two. Both co-founders Nitin and Vasant recommend the founders to A. Target a niche first and then expand. B. Focus on execution through customer acquisition and retention. C. Keep profitability as your North Star. D. Use word of mouth extensively. E. Create a performance-driven culture by hiring the best talent and allocating them ESOPs. Folks, that's it for part 2. The final part 3 of this podcast series is scheduled to go live soon. Meanwhile, Vasant and Nitin, thank you for the wonderful insights. Take care.
Lastly, I want to thank all the listeners who took their valuable time to listen to this podcast. Keep rocking, be safe, and don't forget to share.
Are you a founder of an early-stage startup and looking to raise funding? Please visit www.jazzero.in. That is www.jasaro.in.